This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast. In this episode, we're delighted to share Leah Blankendahl's interview with composer Julian Day.
So I am sitting with Julian Day, about to have what I think is the very first Making Conversations chat, I guess. And to make this extra special, we're recording this in the ABC Classic FM studio. Julian, usually I'd say thank you so much for joining me, but in this case, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being, thanks for dropping by. I'm really looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, this role reversal is very weird, I think. it's a bit strange for me, so forgive me. But why don't we start with something, I guess, a little bit easy. Tell me about where you grew up.
Well, I was born in Bendigo in central Victoria, so former gold mining capital of Australia, and very young moved to Melbourne. So my parents were sort of in the kind of rock and art scene of Melbourne, and so we just lived in a sequence of share houses in the inner suburbs of Melbourne, hobnobbing with future rock and roll stars from, you know, the Bad Seeds and those kind of bands. And I kind of grew up around the objects of music making, because my dad was always singing and playing music in bands. And that was, I guess, those early days in Melbourne really kicked off my lifelong fascination with music.
What's it like growing up in with such, like, ridiculous figures around you?
Well, it was a pretty louche kind of environment. I mean, there was just a lot of hanger-oners and parties and kind of, you know, there was always not only the detritus of music objects like mics and drum kits and amplifiers, but also just, you know, half-empty bottles of cheap alcohol and, you know, various other things. So I just remember those kind of early days just being a kind of a slightly madhouse set of, you know, very arty kind of share houses, but always, I guess, being embedded with this idea that you make a life by playing, and my dad would say, "I'm going out to play." That was his work. So maybe that's always kind of stuck with me.
Can you pinpoint a really like an early musical experience at all?
Yeah, there's probably several, a few, like at three different points in my childhood. First of all, going to hear my dad play at, you know, the Cricketers Arms in Richmond in Melbourne. And I can still remember standing in the middle of the room while my dad's kind of post-punk band was playing raucous music in the corner and just kind of, you know, dancing around as a 4 or 5 year old. And again, this idea that you sort of, you know, that's what you do. You respond to sound and your body responds and you sort of enjoy it as a big thick vibration kind of field. Then when I was about 9, I got really into pop music. I think one day my dad just casually asked if I liked Michael Jackson or some artists like that, and I'd never even heard of them. And it just triggered a great interest in music making. And my aunt around about the same time bought me a little tape recorder, and I think the combination of my parents' record collection, the tape recorder, and this burgeoning interest in pop music just got me spiraling into writing songs and coming up with lyrics and designing record covers and doing little fake radio interviews with myself even. So, and then I think the third point was at high school, watching the film Amadeus, which is obviously a sort of fanciful journey of Mozart's life. But there's a few scenes in that film where this strangely American-voiced Mozart dictates his music, and you hear layer by layer compositions emerging, and I think that just really did it for me. All the other things kind of fell into place, and I knew that I wanted to sculpt sound and that sonic experience.
Yeah, I can't think honestly of too many Western art musicians who would pinpoint Amadeus as the turning point for their musical career. That's such an odd thing to say.
And I think, look, you know, we're a bit sort of highbrow around Classic FM. I think some people would, raise an eyebrow that I would, you know, fall in love with such a populist film.
Not at all. I think that's fabulous. And so what instrument did you start playing?
The early pictures are of me of a shockingly blonde three-year-old playing a pretend drum kit. So I think hitting things was always pretty interesting. I also picked up a synthesizer when I was a kid, and that was just a thing lying around in my dad's belongings. So that became a big trope. But when I actually went to play music in high school, I think I wanted to play the bass guitar, but neither of my parents would let me play such a kind of, worthless instrument. I had to learn something classical, even though neither of my parents were classically minded. And I think they just figured that a flute was the cheapest, most portable object they could find. And so I actually learned the flute.
It's not unreasonable, though. It is. What did your dad play?
He played guitar, and he passed away when I was quite young. And the one object that came to me from him beyond, notebooks and memories and a few books and so forth was his beautiful 1962 blood red Gibson guitar. I got it valued after he died, and the guy said this would be worth an insane amount of money if it hadn't been run over by a truck. And I think my dad, living the rock and roll lifestyle, somehow let it out of his sight at one point. He knew guitar and was a singer, just a really confident sort of lead vocalist for a series of bands.
Yeah, right. So what about your first, the first piece you wrote? Do you have an idea of what that would have been?
Yeah, besides the early pop songs that kind of partly got recorded but sort of generally sat in notebooks, the first composition was that same night I watched Amadeus. I was so inspired by someone who could just come up in his mind and just dictate all the different parts to music that I went into my room and I wrote out a 2-line piece for the flute. And all I did, and this is how inexperienced I was, is I played a melody on a flute, wrote that down, and then thought of a new melody on the flute again and wrote that down as line 2. Neither of them had anything to do with the other, and I think if you heard them, it would just be a whole bunch of minor seconds. That was my first composition, directly inspired by that great man.
But also, quite avant-garde by the sound of it.
That's right, a completely independent counterpoint. I think I took it to my flute teacher that week, and she just, she did the equivalent of big red crosses in the air, just saying, this doesn't make any sense, what the hell?
But, obviously doesn't know contemporary composition.
Exactly. Where are they now? Who knows?
Yeah, right. And so when was it that you started getting formal composition lessons?
Well, my father, who was, having lived the rock and roll lifestyle and not getting hugely far with it, was perpetually short of money. And he gave me two things as an early teen getting really into music. One was, and I feel very touched by this even now, he just made some mixtapes for me of composers like Schubert. I was very into Schubert for a while, and he got a musically-minded friend to dub a whole bunch of Schubert. A very simple act of love and generosity, but one which I've kind of kept with me. And the other thing was he paid for that same person to give me some composition lessons. So, back room of a little Paran house, and this guy who just taught me some of the basics and also taught me the broader landscape of contemporary music in a kind of a classic sense, so like Penderecki and Boulez and Stravinsky and some key 20th century names.
Australia, we get this sort of move to the eastern states, so moving to study in Sydney and study in Melbourne. But that wasn't the path you took, naturally. You ended up in Brisbane, is that right?
Even further north than that beforehand. So I was getting very used to the inner urban hip lifestyle of Melbourne in my early teens and, thinking, well, maybe I might go to the Victorian College of the Arts, even the high school, that'd be awesome. And then my mother met someone when we were on a holiday in far north Queensland, and all of a sudden I moved to a beach just north of Cairns with about, you know, 30 other people in this tiny remote community in the, you know, sub-equator kind of tropics. So about as far removed as I could imagine from the sort of, you know, educated inner suburbs of Melbourne. But it was actually a really useful move, and I discovered that the community up there was really proactive. And so I got a lot into theatre, and this high school there, which was unlike my high school in Melbourne, actually had an orchestra and a concert band. And so I gradually sort of got through a few years in Cairns and then drifted down to go to the conservatorium in Brisbane.
Yeah. What are some of the pleasures of making music in a smaller community?
Well, I guess you kind of just have to kind of do all the things yourself. And there's an easier point of access to just get your hands dirty. So, you know, that it was no great risk to join the local theatre community. There was no great risk in auditioning for the school band. You know, the school had a whole room of musical instruments. So you could just kind of try a bit of everything. And I think doing musicals even in high school, I mean, we just had these regional schools that were really into supporting the arts in a way that the high school I went to in Melbourne sort of had almost no concept of that. So I guess I felt armed with a whole lot of skills.
There's something funny as well about being a big fish in a small pond in those situations as well. You get a lot from that.
Yeah, I still feel inordinately proud of the little, you know, art medal I got in Smithfield High School. And I still got that somewhere. But yeah, of course, that's a huge shock when you then go to even the next biggest town, Brisbane, and you go, okay, yeah, I'm now a tiny fish in even a moderate-sized sea.
And so who did you study with when you got to uni?
I had Jared Brophy was my primary teacher at the conservatorium there. He's still there. I also had some extra lessons with Stephen Leake, who I really fell in love with his music. Very direct, very kind of engaged approach, really stripped back but very evocative harmonies. And I had a teacher for a little while called Nigel Sabin, who was playing with one of the ensembles in Brisbane, Perihelion. And he had a really interesting combo of a kind of a serialist interest but also really kind of accessible orchestral music. So between those three, it was quite a good mix.
Do you see any kind of lasting impact on your music at all from them?
Well, Stephen Leake, who's very big into choral music, I am very drawn to the voice and particularly choirs for one particular reason, which is that choirs, because there's no fixed pitch, it's not a group of pianists who can all play a mid or C. Everyone depends on each other to pitch and to understand where they're at. And so on the one hand, there's a very airy kind of weightlessness about massed voices. But also there's a great communal dependence on each other, and that's been a really significant influence on my later work. And the other thing from Jared Brophy, I mean, I was early interested in his kind of very coloristic pieces and very rhythmically driven post-minimal kind of pieces. But I've realised lately that the really strong thing I got from him was another approach to ensemble writing. He had a series of pieces at the time which were bringing together instruments that had no obvious connection, like maybe piano, cello, and bass clarinet. They're all from a very different set of families, and the way you make sound in those instruments is very different from one another. But he would write in such a way that they would find the overlaps. So clearly those three instruments can all play low. And so he then started to write these almost like super solo pieces, but with a group playing the solo line together. And I think that's been really influential because it's taught me to look for the overlaps and the commonalities between things rather than the differences. And I think that's been very meaningful in terms of working with groups of people where you might have very, very different people from very different backgrounds, but there's always some overlaps that you can find and work within those zones.
Yeah, sure. So let's talk composition, I guess. And I'm going to pose you a question. If you had a blank check and unlimited time, what would you write for me now?
if I wrote it now, how would the unlimited time?
blank check, unlimited time, doesn't have to be now.
Right. Meet you in 10 years.
Yeah.
Gosh, what would I do? Oh, I'm really drawn to very interesting spaces. And that's a big reason why I've been really interested in galleries, because they're just very interesting, big open chambers. You can do some very interesting acoustic things without the concept of there necessarily being a stage. So I'd probably try and write something for a really interesting location. I mean, there's some iconic big spaces in the art world, like the Spiral Chamber of the Guggenheim in New York, or the giant Turbine Hall of Tate Modern. So I'd probably, if money was no object, I'd just go to one of those very, well-known tick the box kind of space. And we've already talked about this idea of groups that where you find overlaps, and I've just always been really interested in these big ensembles of like instruments. So I'd probably, try and find a few dozen pianos or 100 flute players who might want to work with me, or even 1,000 pebbles or something where I can really just play with that one kind of space in an unusual location.
Yeah, it seems to me like your work has a lot of sort of tangibility to it, and a very visual, you rely on visual mediums a lot. Where do you think that comes from?
Probably a bit of indecision, trying to work out what to study at uni. Should I do art? Should I do music? Should I write? And so in a sense, it's just being a bit greedy about the senses and wanting to draw in more than what I trained to do. But I guess I also feel like, making music is an act in the world, and it is an action and a process. I don't see it as a static work. So I'm less drawn to the idea of spending a long time over a score that the meaning then resides in the score or in the recording or in the one time it gets played. I'm really interested in how that generates an action and something that happens in time and in space. And I guess I feel like that once you think that way, you can't really take out all the other elements unless you want to deliberately strip them back. So I've done some works that are completely in the dark. There was a work I worked on with a long-term collaborator, Luke Yannister, where we developed a work for a dozen saxophones that would surround the audience at the Sydney Opera House in pitch blackness. But besides those kind of ideas, I just feel like, we're talking now and we're looking at each other. Unless we had some vision impairment, we would have to close our eyes to not deal with the sense that we're in a room. And so why not deal with all those different elements?
So one of the first pieces I ever heard of yours was a piece called Social Systems, in which two bass clarinets play, I think, a game of Snap. And you're sort of playing on what you call social games. What is that concept?
Well, again, rather than rely on a very fixed score where I demand everyone starts at the same time and practices forever at home, I'd rather a much looser approach to how people come together.
It's very generous of you.
It's very generous. I love games and I love sport as a concept. I'm so flabby and out of shape and I don't do any sport. But I love the idea that there's something very unpredictable and yet designed about a game. And so if you play a game of Monopoly, you know what the rules are and you know that there's going to be a general linear process, but, 1,000 games will have 1,000 different outcomes, and I find that very exciting. So Social Systems is the beginning of hopefully a set of pieces, which are just variants on games that people know, or little games where there's an element of both cooperation and competition, which I think is at the essence of good sports. So Social Systems, as you say, featured a couple of bass clarinetists. It was a game of Snap, so there's two dealers who hand out cards. If you want to do the full version, I was acting as a kind of compere / umpire with a whiteboard and a little visor like you might find in a casino. And we filmed both tables. So as an audience member, you could see this dialogue of two screens as well. And I thought the sound result was kind of fun. I really enjoyed hearing it. It was just you had to come in when you saw your card that signified which note you'd play. But because there was that kind of fun, competitive element, it really kind of broke it up and became a curious meta comment on the ensemble, on the nature of playing in an ensemble.
And it was performed by Ensemble Offspring, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's it like having, that kind of situation needs a really open-minded performer. Do you find that exists in Australia?
Well, Ensemble Offspring is a very good example. I tend to like to work with groups who are interested in trying new things. So they're one of the East Coast's foremost examples. I've done some work also with Decibel on the West Coast.
Yeah, sure.
Kat Hope's ensemble.
She's phenomenal.
She is absolutely phenomenal. She's one of my heroes. And I guess, I mean, part of the big thing I've done is generate ensembles that just exist for that one event and sort of disperse again quickly afterwards. The very temporary kind of groups or temporary communities, as I like to call them. And when you're building a group of people who want to get involved in that, there's a natural opt-in commitment, because otherwise, why would they join you?
So this is a, I guess, a difficult question, because you talk so much about people being involved in your music in quite a meaningful way. If nobody heard your music, would you still write it?
Ooh, it's a kind of a version of that, if a tree falls in the forest, would anyone hear it? And that's interesting, because I've just last night finished a review of a book that opens with that very line and talks about a lot of the concepts I'm really interested in. It's called Sensing Sound. That book actually poses that question in an interesting way, because it says, unless you're a musicologist or contemplating the nature of being, the sound is actually really unimportant, and there's a whole lot of other factors that would be more relevant. Like if you're anywhere near a forest and a tree falling, for instance, you're going to have a lot more concern about the grit of the dirt flying in your eye, the sky darkening because the trees are kind of, you know, falling on top of you. You might hear the big thump of the vibration as the tree falls. I mean, that's if you are near the tree. Of course, if you're nowhere near it, that's moot. But I guess because sound and audition is only one part of the process, there's always an action, there's always an intention, and sometimes sound is not heard. I suppose, yes, I would still do it. But I suppose if the point was no one actually ever encountered my work, I'd just probably feel a bit sad.
I'm glad you swung around there in the end. Get to the question, right, day.
Sorry.
It's okay. And just because I think you're probably the busiest person I've ever met, you've also released an album quite recently called, what is it?
It's White on White.
Yeah. And you describe it as sort of a durational sound project. What does that mean?
Well, yeah, in a musical context, what does durational mean? It's a bit sort of tautological. Effectively, I work with very long sounds, so they're drones. And I guess it's my kind of getting back at the struggle I did of trying to become a pianist and not getting anywhere with it, despite spending 10 years at the goddamn thing. So when I kind of came back to wanting to work with keyboards, I just wanted to go super simple. And so I just started collecting almost throwaway consumer grade keyboards, and one of the great things they can do is that you just weigh down the keys and they will just do something for you. It's a very on-off kind of system. And so over the past 5 or 6 years, I've been building a practice around these little keyboards that I've just found on eBay or that have come into my collection somehow very cheaply. Sometimes they've become installations. So I did a long series of works called Lovers, or alternately Requiem, where I'd pin apart identical synthesizers with long metal rods in different parallel locations, sometimes floor to ceiling, sometimes two parallel walls, sometimes very discreet, sometimes can't really not notice them because you have to walk between them and hope that they don't fall on you. And the performance side of that has been to do the same, but to pair keyboards and use weights like bolts and to find very simple geometric patterns that generate pieces. But the point is not that they're very logical, ordered patterns. That's just the starting point. The point is that combined, they create very dense ways of treating the air. And the project itself is called An Infinity Room, which has a whole bunch of associations, but the acronym is AIR. And I guess the way I see it is it's like an air conditioning project. It's like you're changing the nature, the color, the feel of the air through these aggregating sounds. And White on White is simply several pieces in that form using these matching keyboards in a very reverberant space.
Yeah. And I don't think we can be here and talk without addressing, I guess, the elephant in the ABC studios, which is that you're also a broadcaster.
Yeah.
How do you balance that kind of commitment?
I've got it down to a fine art. And as you say, I'm pretty busy and I wear several hats, usually take them off very quickly and throw on the next one. I see all the things I do as being pretty related. I mean, I think what I do on air, which is really to promote and talk about the work of artists that I love, musicians that I really respect, you know, this great body of contemporary music predominantly, but also art in general and the history of classical music. I mean, even the fact that it is on air, and my research project in many ways has been about air and the idea of transmission through space and the idea of communities that come together for reasons other than they happen to all be from Russia, or they all happen to be women, or they all happen to be of a particular age group. Radio actually does that really beautifully. You know, we can be listening to the same station at the same time in completely different parts of the country or the world. We might have nothing else in common except that we're sharing that act together in real time. And that's really informed my way of thinking about ensembles and groups of people coming together and connecting through sound, but often in invisible or unexpected ways. So it's always about talking about sound or talking about music, talking about community, talking about space. So whether it's a gallery, a radio studio, or playing with some musicians, it all seems to kind of come together in my head.
So I have quite a special question, I think, from one of our project patrons, Cameron Lamb, and I think it kind of feeds into what you're talking about. What outside of music most inspires you?
It's probably a very obvious one, which is contemporary art. I mean, I followed my undergraduate composition degree with a degree at art school. And so, I mean, when I'm not listening to music, I'm going to see exhibitions. I'd like to say I'm a big reader. I always try and get into novels, but I read a lot of nonfiction. And so I guess reading is the other thing. I know my beautiful partner, have to mention them.
Sure. And when you are composing, how do you assess if something isn't working?
Gosh, I think that's an ongoing question throughout your life as an artist. There's many ways of answering that. I mean, you could see how much resonance it has with your peers and the artists you're working with. I don't know. I mean, I guess I always like to create works that have a resonance in several ways. One is that I feel like I'm trying to convey a concept. Another is that it has some resonance contextually, so it actually talks to the situation that it's happening in. I think kind of come up with things that are very abstract, like just write a string quartet. Makes less sense to me than what does it mean for these four musicians playing strings to come together on a stage and to talk to that contextual thing. And also I do really just enjoy interesting, immersive sound. So if I can bring those three things together, then I feel happy. Supercritical Mass is a project which is kind of like a take on the orchestra or the choir, but coming at it from a few different angles that are not quite the orchestra or the choir. I mean, you may have this experience of going through music school or going through training and learning that there is a kind of peak body of musicians you're meant to aim for. And as a classical performer, it's typically the orchestra. And if you're a composer, it's typically the orchestra. It's really the kind of heavily funded cultural object that we all seem to aspire towards. And I love the orchestra and I'd like to be writing for it, but it also throws up a whole bunch of challenges. One is economic and social. I mean, it's a very expensive thing to put together professionally. It's kind of crystallized. I mean, I guess about a century ago, it sort of stopped growing in a very obvious way. So it's got very rigid hierarchies and roles. Because it's an expensive body to operate, and because playing in it, it just demands such peak playing, it can often attract a sort of, I guess, segments of the community that have the resources to learn the flute for 25 years, to get a good violin, to be at a good school that gives you that kind of training. So whilst I love the orchestra, I feel like, you know, I was never going to be able to play in one. The chances of me writing for one are pretty slim. I wanted to somehow create a context in which I could work on a big scale, maybe even play in it myself, and also do the things that orchestras typically don't do, which is to actually really consider the space that they're in as their actual instrument. I mean, concert halls are very standardized and they've been that way for at least a century, and there's very good reason for it. If you've got an orchestra that's touring or a repertoire that needs a very neutral kind of sound, you wouldn't go into a cave or play on a beach or play in the street. So Superkudokumas basically began as a way to create an orchestral force that would be very lithe, very mobile, wouldn't necessarily have all the apparatus of an orchestra, music stands, rehearsals, a conductor, wouldn't have the kind of hierarchies of an orchestra. I'm basically trying to destroy the orchestra from within. And would also have a particular sound, which would be, instead of all of the colours of the orchestra, just one colour at a time. So an example, basically the first event we did was for 80 flutes in a very reverberant concrete chamber, which was Carriage Works, a former railway workshop in Sydney. No leader, so the pieces that were developed were just instructions and they were just verbally memorised by the musicians. And it was a very porous experience too, because the audience would just flood through the space and they would actually become a kind of architecture that the musicians would deal with. Whilst also using the space as a kind of score. Carriage Works, as I say, was a railway workshop, and you have all these parallel tracks embedded in the ground. And so that obviously became a very easy way to direct them. Like, let's have this piece where you actually play along the tracks. Let's have this piece where you're down the corridors. Let's have this piece where you're clumping and expanding as a group, almost where the social interaction really becomes the structure of the work. And also, let's really engage with this beautiful resonant 5-second delay kind of acoustic.
Yeah.
And it's just grown into a decade-long project for all different kinds of massed identical ensembles in all different kind of places.
Yeah. I was about to ask where you get 80 flutes from, but I don't even think that's a question. There are so many.
Flute's a bit of a low-lying branch, it has to be said.
It's a good place to start for a project like that. You didn't start to start with 80 bass trombones or anything.
No, and I must add a couple of other names. Janet McKay, who's a really extraordinary flute player, she founded the project with me. We brought in Luke Yannister, who also learnt the flute like I did, and originally a composer, Damien Barbalur, who has a lot to do with voice, and he may well even have learnt the flute too. And yeah, look, it's not hard to find a lot of flutes. Some people criticise it at first, going, oh God, like one flute's enough. Why do you want 80? I think it's a stunning, yeah, charming, beautiful orchestral sound.
Haters gonna hate, Julia.
Haters gonna hate, exactly. You know, embrace it.
I'm a flute player a long time ago.
I knew that, so you know, I know I'm in good company here.
Thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been great to chat.
Making Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, project patron Cameron Lamb of Camaclang, and Creative Partnerships Australia's match funding program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney, and Peggy Polias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Marlena Radice, and Mark Wolfe. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Elia Simic Prozic. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support.